The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business.
On February 10, 2009, the Korea Society hosted a talk with Scott Snyder, director of the Center for Korea Policy at the Asia Foundation, and author of China's Rise and the Two Koreas, Politics, Economics, Security. Snyder spoke about recent developments in China's relationship with both North and South Korea with John Delury, Associate Director of Asia Society's Center on U.S.-China Relations.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Evans Revere, the President of the Korea Society, and I want to welcome you all here today. It really is a pleasure to have so many folks here today for what I think is going to be a fascinating program. Those of you who know me, and there are a few in the room who do, know that I began my career as a China hand. And very early on, I was stationed in our embassy in Beijing back in the day when China was still experimenting with their economic reforms. And this was back before those economic reforms brought about a period of incredibly explosive growth. And back in those days, I remember writing report after report in the embassy in Beijing about what this all meant for not only China's domestic economy and politics and society, but also what it meant for the economics and politics of China's relations with others, including the Koreas. And even earlier in my career, I remember vaguely back 100 years ago when I was young, writing my dissertation on China's traditional relationship with Korea and the decline of that relationship in the late 19th and early 20th century. And I vaguely remember saying a thing or two in that dissertation about whether and how China and Korea might be able to reconstitute that traditional relationship. And all of those musings and reports, et cetera, didn't amount to very much back then. And it's just as well, because I could not have done as well as our guest, special guest today, Scott Snyder, has done in addressing all of these issues and a lot more in a very thoughtful and well-done book, which I highly commend to you. I'm really pleased to have Scott, who's an old friend here, and I'm equally pleased to be able to work with the Asia Society in bringing you today's program. They are a co-sponsor and have helped us put this excellent program together today. And I'm particularly delighted to have the Asia Society's John Delury here, who will be our moderator for the program, and so you won't be hearing any more from me. I think that's a good thing. John is one of the best young China hands in America today, and I think you will find him and his moderation to your satisfaction. And so it's really an honor for me to welcome both of my colleagues and good friends here today and to turn the podium and the program over to them. And if you will, please welcome them with a round of applause. Thank you.
Well, I'm certainly one of the least ignorant people in this room when it comes to Korean issues, but have been working on it, and I feel more comfortable with the China side of things. So I was delighted to have this chance to talk with you, Scott, about your book. I may be a good substitute for at least some people in this crowd who just are learning from every page of the book, as I was. Maybe the simplest place to start, for those who haven't started reading it, would be if you could just lay out the overarching thesis, because I think one thing you have in the book is a very strong kind of central argument about the relationship between economics and politics, basically. Maybe if we could start with that, then I have a series of questions that we can dig into more of the details.
Okay. Really, one of the primary things that I wanted to explore when I set out to write this book was the relationship between economic interdependence and political and security leverage. And in particular, I had followed the initial phase of the China-Korea relationship, and I'd noticed that it was growing very rapidly, 20% a year, 30% a year in the 1990s, from the time of normalization. And I was at a conference where I had a chance to ask one of the South Korean scholars, well, is this an issue? Is this going to affect the security relationship between the U.S. and South Korea? And he said, well, no, you don't need to worry. Unless the China-South Korea trade relationship becomes bigger than the U.S.-Korea trade relationship, there's nothing to worry about. The U.S.-Korea alliance will be solid. And, of course, if we look at it today, the China-South Korea trade relationship is, in fact, twice as large as the U.S.-Korea trade relationship. So I'm happy to report that that South Korean scholar was exactly wrong about the relationship between economic interdependence and political and security leverage as it relates to China and South Korea. And in fact, what I tried to do in the book was to explore that question by analyzing in what ways, in fact, China might be able to use its growing economic influence on the Korean Peninsula. And I had two case studies. One was with North Korea, and the other was with South Korea. And I think I was actually a little bit surprised by where I came out as well because of where I started with this hypothesis that my Korean colleague had given. But essentially what I discovered is that, in fact, growing economic and trade relations and China's growing influence on the peninsula does not necessarily provide a specific type of political or security leverage. In particular, it's very difficult to use economic instruments as leverage on specific issues in terms of influencing political and security dynamics on the peninsula. And with North Korea, maybe North Korea is really the more interesting case in some respects, because North Korea is so dependent on China for its food and for its energy. But if we look at the way the relationship has developed, I think China really has tried to use its economic influence, particularly in the context of the nuclear crisis, in order to influence North Korea to take into account security and stability in the region. But in fact, the North Korean nuclear test, in many respects, was an example of how the attempt to use economic influence, in particular by expanding trade and investment in North Korea, in fact, failed to deliver the kind of leverage that I think the Chinese might have hoped they would be able to have in the initial stages. And in the book, I show that from about 2002, the beginning of the crisis, in fact, the Chinese really try to ramp up their economic relationship with North Korea as part of an attempt to enhance their political influence. But that's not really what happened. In the case of South Korea, you know, that's a completely different case in many respects because South Korea is a vibrant, growing economy. What we saw there was a real attraction to China and really the overall relationship being driven by economic opportunity in the initial phase in the 1990s, and then a second phase of very vibrant growth between from 2001, 2002, from China's entry into the WTO. And I think that many outside of observers, when they looked at that relationship, one question that many people were asking in the United States and in other parts of the region was, well, why is South Korea so interested in economic relations with China but not concerned about the potential security or political impact? Well, that kicked in around 2006. And initially, it kicked in as a result of South Korean recognition that, in fact, China was competing with South Korea, especially in third country markets, and in fact taking market share away from South Korean products. So one thing that I find very interesting about the way that South Korea has responded to this particular growth is that initially they weren't concerned about the political and security impact, subsequently they became concerned about China primarily as an economic competitor. And then subsequently, I think that what we have seen is as South Korea has become more aware of and concerned about their own economic dependence on China, they themselves have attempted to diversify their trade and investment relations. So in both cases, what I found was that, in fact, growing economic interdependence between China and the two Koreas does not necessarily, at least so far, it has not led to any kind of special advantage for China in terms of pressing its own political or security agenda on the peninsula.
Great. That's a great kind of big picture. So if we break this down a little bit more, one thing that makes the Northeast Asian politics and the six-party talks framework so interesting is that you have sort of six variables. It's like a math equation where it's all variables, and you have to keep constantly watching each one as it changes. One thing you do, I think, very well in the book is break it down and focus on the China-South Korea and the China-North Korea, those sort of bilaterals economically, and then step back to look at, again, the many variables surrounding it, focusing maybe especially in the background, I think, is what does this mean for U.S. policy, which maybe we can get to later on. Why don't we start with the China-South Korea relationship. One thing I found interesting is that you chart these sort of three phases that more or less, since normalization in 92, that more or less coincide with new leadership in South Korea, I suppose. Maybe you could lay that out for this group that may be somewhat familiar stuff, but some comments on that. And then something that we see less of in the book, because it is still happening, is email inbox administration, and is that sort of a fourth phase? I don't know that you comment as much directly, so I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay, well, it does turn out that in terms of the development of the relationship, the phases kind of match up nicely with the changes in leadership in South Korea. 92 to 1997 was really Kim Yong-sam managing the relationship with Jiang Zemin. Very initial development of the relationship, driven a lot by economic growth, but a lot of it was really driven by South Korean desire to look for low labor cost locations in order to produce for the U.S. market. We saw that, in fact, there was the development of what some people have called the Bohai Economic Zone. It was really mostly around the West Sea. And there was a lot of one thing that's interesting about the relationship as it developed then was a surprising amount of small and medium industries getting involved. But a lot of it was really focused on labor-intensive industry, and it was really focused on export to the U.S. The next phase in the relationship, in a way, I think that it could be characterized as a kind of setback, because under Kim Dae-jung, they had the Asian financial crisis, and there was a period of adjustment, I think, in the economic relationship, maybe a period of taking stock. One thing I find very interesting about that particular phase is that China had begun really to look more seriously at South Korea as a potential model for its own development. And then, of course, we had this financial crisis, and they had to step back and say, well, maybe not everything about what South Korea has done is all good. But it's interesting, you know, the South Korean side also kind of used, and this is quite relevant today, they used their experience in the financial crisis also at a later stage in order to develop another aspect of the economic relationship, and that was their own experience with the Korean Asset Management Company that was set up in order to basically do the same kinds of things that we're all, I think that Tim Geithner kind of, you know, announced something today that sounds really quite similar to the Korea Asset Management Company that had been set up, which was really a quasi-public vehicle by which to try to deal with bad debt, and in particular companies that were going under. Well, one thing I find interesting is that the Koreans, you know, made lemonade out of lemons in the financial crisis, and they also, CAMCO became very active in terms of helping the Chinese to also deal with some of those issues at that particular period in the relationship. And then I think a third phase really, it coincides with Nomuhyan, and it was a real boom in terms of I guess a second takeoff or a second phase of growth in China-Korea relations. And it coincides with the Nomuhyan period, but I think more importantly, it really coincides with China's entry into the WTO. And here what we see is South Korea, in terms of some of their larger sectors, jumping into the China market with both feet. We see the Chaebol getting involved. We see the growth, in particular, of investment in the Shanghai region. And we see Korean companies trying to capture some of the Chinese domestic market, in particular in terms of telecommunications, cell phones. We see the growth of the Korean investment in the auto sector. And we also see, I think, the consolidation of a more active, I think they called it all-around cooperative partnership, at the political level that was very much involved with South Korean political leadership focusing on how can we reinforce some of the potential opportunities that were taking place in the China market. And this was a period of very rapid growth in terms of trade between China and Korea. It was a slightly different, it was driven by a slightly different model because what we have in this phase is a lot of inter-company trading that also boosted some of the trade numbers. But we also see a very significant focus on Korean investment into China. I mentioned the auto sector, steel. There are many Korean companies that began to move into China, particularly with a focus on the Chinese consumer market. And you mentioned a fourth phase, or I didn't really quite get a chance to cover this in the way that it might be covered. But now we have a strategic partnership between Im Young-bak and Hu Jintao that was announced last May. We also have a little bit more of a dark edge, in a way, to the China-Korea economic relationship. And in particular, for instance, beginning of last year, the Chinese tried to encourage investment in higher value added rather than labor-intensive sectors, so they passed a new labor law. That had direct impact in terms of some of the Korean labor-intensive industries that had been so active in the 90s. And so we saw some of these new issues, problems coming up in the relationship. Fly-by-night companies, managers who decided that they were going to leave without basically paying the bills, those kinds of things, shuttering their doors. And so, and we also see a period where China is eating into South Korean competitiveness in some of the core industries that South Korea has long prided itself as being a leader in. One of the things that I find interesting about this phase is that at least at one point last year, Chinese steel companies were taking business from Korean steel companies in terms of selling to some of the Korean shipbuilders and some of the Korean automakers because they were very competitive on price. And so a lot of those types of issues have been coming up. And now, of course, we have the financial crisis, which is also, I think, changing the game.
Well, yeah, if I can interject, I mean, the financial crisis hit, I suppose, after the manuscript was submitted to some extent.
Yes.
But it does raise lots of interesting questions about your argument. I'd love to hear you thinking aloud about this stuff, because one thing you put forward here, and this gets into some of the probably the political science and IR theory that I can't follow as well with a background in history, but the idea of trade expectations, you know, and if there's rising hopes that trade's going to keep getting better, then there's a diminished chance of conflict. You know, in the period that you're focused here on, mostly things were booming. I mean, it was mostly a story of growth for China and South Korea. Now, of course, it's, you know, everything seems to be 30%, you know, 30% drop in this, 30% drop in exports, 30%, you know. So what does this mean? And are you already seeing a new picture emerging because the economics of the situation of their bilateral is changing so dramatically?
Yeah, I know. I mentioned before we came out here that I kind of felt like I had written this too early now because of the significance and the impact of the financial crisis. And you're absolutely right. I talked in the book about this theory of trade expectations as being a very important lens through which we could understand why China and South Korea normalized in the first place. And why the China-North Korea relationship, why it was so easy for China in the end to set that relationship aside. Because, you know, even back in the 80s, in fact, in some respects, what's remarkable is that the Chinese waited as long as they did to go ahead and normalize with South Korea. You know, even back in the 80s, it was clear that trade was a driver for an improved China-South Korea relationship. Now, for the first time, we have a situation where there's a shrinking pie. There's the possibility, prospect that, in fact, there won't be double-digit growth. There are double-digit declines. And this is probably going to lead to frictions, or it could serve to bring to the surface frictions that have already been existing. But in the past, politically, it was easy to ignore those frictions. And so I think that it'll be very interesting to see. Already, I think that it's not really economically focused, but I already sense from conversations that I've had with Chinese colleagues a greater concern about, well, where exactly is South Korea going politically? And then if you add this economic aspect to it, one can imagine that now is the time when this particular relationship might actually be tested. I'll just mention one other thing that I've kind of been mulling over, and that is I think a lot of the South Korean trade and investment with China occurred with the thought that that it was part of a process of delinking from the United States. But in fact, I think that what we have found is it's exactly the opposite. And in particular, I would cite the South Korean central bank's relationship with the Federal Reserve and the credit line that they needed to get last fall. So, in fact, it turns out that the idea of delinking or the idea of South Korea's economy being tied to China and less exposed to the United States, well, I think that particular theory has kind of been discredited over the course of the last couple of months.
Yeah, that's an interesting Koda. Let's switch over now to the China-North Korea relationship. One of the interesting things I found in your book is the point you make, or the argument that for all its aid, and I think that would be the first interesting question, is you've done a lot of work on this, of the best number we can get in terms of how much aid China is actually delivering to North Korea. You had some really interesting statistics and analysis on that. So that would be first, just empirically, how much is it? And then secondly, your analysis that really it doesn't buy them much in a way, that there's this sort of paradox where they actually become somehow indebted to North Korea through the aid. If you could flesh that out, it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Well, I do have in the book some specific numbers from trade figures that in particular highlight the nature of the China-North Korea relationship in the area of grain and energy. And I kind of tracked the way in which grain and energy have flowed from China to North Korea over the course of the past 10 or 15 years. But I don't want to get people's hopes up. I do not have specific numbers about China's aid to North Korea because I couldn't get them. Instead, what Chinese scholars will give is a kind of overall picture. And so a few years ago, it was, well, China's aid to North Korea represents about a third of its overall budget for overseas assistance. That was about, I think, 2000-2001 period. And then about 2 years ago, I heard that, it's actually about 40% now of China's overall assistance to North Korea. But because those figures are classified in China, I was not able to get the exact numbers. But if we think about it, I mean, what that shows is that China's assistance to North Korea has gone up. Also, we know that China's overall overseas assistance has gone up.
It's the third largest, is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Third largest donor in the world now. Of course, now that you mentioned that, and now that I said that, I recognize that I don't have the empirical figure to prove it, but I do have a footnote that I used that somebody else cited related to that. One of the things that's very interesting about the China-North Korea relationship that a lot of people don't, I think, have forgotten or didn't realize is that, in fact, to a certain extent, well, in the early 1990s, they were really trying to disengage themselves economically from this burden, this economic burden that they faced in terms of what they were doing with North Korea. And, of course, it was really a state-planned relationship where, in the old days, essentially the North Koreans would ask the Chinese central planners, how much are you going to give us now for the next 5 years? It was kind of targeted to the five-year plan. But the Chinese tried to disengage. They wanted to go to market pricing back in the 1990s, especially for grain and oil. And to a certain extent, there is a case to be made for the idea that Chinese efforts to wean North Korea from assistance might have been one cause of the famine in North Korea in the mid-1990s. Subsequent to that, I think in the midst of the famine, the Chinese really were the early responder because they recognized that if they didn't pour food and assistance into North Korea, that North Koreans were going to be in northeastern China. So they actually responded before the World Food Program did and before the South Koreans did. And I didn't really cover that here, but I've covered it in some other work that I've done. And then I think in the next phase, what we see is a situation where, as China became more involved from 2002 in responding to the nuclear crisis, they really tried to use their assistance to North Korea as a way of trying to enhance their influence. And so we see a major increase over the course of the past 5 years in terms of both China's assistance to North Korea in numerical terms and the percentage share of China's assistance to North Korea. Now, one thing that I find very interesting about that is that as China has tried to increase its influence, it's induced anxieties in South Korea. I think we all know and have read about that. But it's interesting to look at how the South Koreans have also been enhancing their economic engagement with North Korea, really in a way that is a little bit competitive. And so I think that you could almost say that from Kim Jong-il's perspective, the situation as it has worked out in the last 3 or 4 years, it's very familiar to him and it's very comfortable to him, because that's the game that North Korea, that's the game his father played with the Soviet Union and China back in the 70s and 80s. Try to induce strategic anxieties and then go to the other party and get them to double down. And so I think that in many respects that's what North Korea is really attempting to do. I mean, just last week, after the party international liaison department head Wang Jiade went to North Korea, the North Koreans announced that the Chinese had given what the North Koreans called free aid. Well, this is the country that relies on Juche, right? They're self-reliant. So what are they doing advertising their assistance that they're receiving from another country? Well, I think probably part of it is to try to encourage others to come in.
Paralleling that is the, so one is the issue of aid, which you don't see getting much political leverage, and the for China, the biggest example of that obviously being the fact that North Korea went ahead and tested a nuclear explosion in 06. Then the other side is trade and investment. What did you find there? Because that's another one where it's very hard to come by hard numbers. How do you assess the volume of Chinese trade and investment with North Korea? And to what extent is that, you argue it's not transformative, it's not creating marketization or capitalism, certainly in North Korea, but to what extent is it having some impact, at least locally, regionally, in parts of North Korea, maybe in ways that's more effective than what South Korea is doing in Kaesong and these other big projects?
Yeah, no, I think it hasn't been transformative yet, but in a way it is, in a way it's the most dangerous thing that's going on in terms of being a threat to the North Korean leadership. I mentioned that, we do have trade figures, and, they're in the book, showing this really growth in the trade relationship over the course of the past 5 years at 20-30% rates. And it's hard to really break down the components of that in terms of how much of it might also be assistance versus trade. And then another aspect of the China DPRK trade numbers is that some people argue that it only captures a portion of what's actually going on across the border. Another way of putting it is, the customs office is open between 9 and 5, but it doesn't mean that people don't try to do business during the off hours. So I actually think that a lot of those trading relationships with supplying North Korean markets are a potential source of a challenge, really, to the regime in North Korea. But it's very complicated because most of the North Koreans are trying to control most of it. So, we're talking about barter traders in a way are the greatest threat, but then there's also a kind of state-to-state relationship that in terms, for instance, of state-owned enterprises. And there I think that what we see that is really interesting over the course of the past few years is greater willingness by Chinese state-owned enterprises and large companies to invest in North Korea, but primarily driven by energy security motives. And so we see cross-border investment into North Korea in the natural resources sector. It's not yet really significant. It depends on how you look at it. It's not really significant on the Chinese side. I think it is significant in terms of North Korea because other than this other deal, the Orascom deal that was announced recently, China has really been the only significant emergent partner that has been engaged in investment in North Korea. And then another piece of it that makes it a little bit complicated is that some Chinese investment is really aid. So, for instance, the Chinese built a glass factory, $24 million glass factory in Pyongyang back in 2005. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. It's an interesting example of Chinese investment in North Korea. Talked to a Chinese colleague and said, oh, no, that's development assistance. That's not investment. So, you know, there are things that are happening on the border. It's very mixed. One interesting exercise now that there is this kind of investment and trade going on is to try to get a sense from Chinese private sector people about what they are learning. I have heard some anecdotes that suggest that some Chinese companies have learned the hard way. They've fallen basically for a bait and switch where a North Korean firm would do a little bit of business with them and try to build up and then pull the rug out from under them, disappear. For any purely private sector operation in China, they really don't have much recourse. I think even the state-owned enterprises, it does mean that it can be handled through diplomatic channels, but, well, we know how the North Koreans negotiate, so one can imagine that that would be a very challenging set of issues for China and North Korea to try to manage.
Evans warned us we have a formidable group out here who's going to want to ask questions. So before we open it up, on the sort of, you know, practical policy implications, maybe especially for the U.S., what do you think the conclusions of your study are in terms of maybe focus it a little bit more on something like, at Asia Society, we just had Chris Hill come and give a talk on the six-party talks, from the six-party talks to, Northeast Asian peace or Northeast Asian security mechanism, which is something you talk about and make some interesting points, I think, about from the Chinese perspective. They like the idea of a Northeast Asia security mechanism, but for them it means the U.S. has to let go of its traditional alliances, right? And so Japan, South Korea, Australia, you can go down the line, Taiwan, what this means. So it sounds good at the beginning. It sounds like we can all agree this would be a good thing, but it's a very different meaning from that Chinese, more national interest perspective. What do you see happening, and what are the suggestions you could make to the new group of Americans who will presumably be unnamed as of yet, be dealing with this? If they read your book, what would they come out of it knowing?
Okay. Well, there's a lot of different strands to that, and so I'm going to try to make it as clear as I can. With regard to South Korea's future, South Korea really is seeking, in terms of its own diplomatic strategy vis-a-vis the U.S. And China, to avoid being put into a situation where they have to make a choice between the two sides, because they're in this very interesting and complicated situation where they're depending on the United States for security. They've been depending on China for economic growth. And so the key for them is really the strategy of not having to make a choice. A second factor with regard to South Korea is really, and I think we didn't get into this, but there's this new China-Korea history issue that came up in 2004 over this ancient kingdom that spanned the China-Korea border. But I think that what that particular episode shows is that the key to winning South Korea is to be less hegemonic, to be less the big power, to try to act more cooperative and engaged. And in a way, I think the Chinese have a little bit of a disadvantage in that regard, simply because they're right next door, whereas we're a little bit further away. With regards to North Korea, I think that the North Koreans, through all of this diplomacy in the context of the six-party talks, what they've really been looking for is the strategic relationship with the United States. I personally think that it's probably unattainable on the terms in which they are imagining it, but part of it is actually for them trying to get away from China a little bit. Again, trying to diversify. They've got the China-South Korea angle. They'd like to add the China-U.S. angle to that. And so I think that, in fact, there is a strong desire in North Korea among within the North Korean government, I think, to improve or even normalize the relationship with the United States. It's just that they may not want to give up anything in order to attain that particular strategic relationship. You know, I find it interesting that at an earlier stage in the talks between U.S. and DPRK, the North Koreans said, yeah, well, we'd like to be like India. I think that's the way they look at it. Then in terms of the Northeast Asia Peace and Security Mechanism or the future of six-party talks, it seems to me that one of the very interesting and challenging issues is really related to how the U.S. alliances are going to be viewed in the context of a growing multilateral security cooperation in Asia. And, of course, the North Koreans have treated those two as in opposition to each other. I think the Chinese also kind of see the alliances as, well, to quote the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, a historical relic that should be replaced by a kind of cooperative mechanism. And so I think one challenge is to manage while we're engaging in, you know, the possibility of developing a Northeast Asia peace and security mechanism. I personally am expecting that the alliance structure is probably not going to go away. Certainly, it's not going to go away under circumstances where there are still perceived security dilemmas or threats. So, I mean, that's a series of recommendations or highlights that I think really kind of come out of a lot of the themes and arguments that I tried to explore in the book.
Okay, well, maybe we can, I might still interject. I still have a long list of questions, but I should moderate myself and open it up to questions from the floor.
Two microphones will be circulating, so if you would please raise your hand, state your name, affiliation if possible, and wait for the microphone because we're on the record. Thank you.
My name is Alan Borstein, and I was the first to manufacture any products in the Orient after World War II for import to the United States. First in Japan, and then in South Korea, Taiwan, and China. And I lived there for reasonable lengths of time, weeks, not years. And one of the issues was currency, which you didn't mention. With the Japanese yen fixed at 360 to the dollar, and it's now under 90, that changes a great deal in reference to not barter trade, but trade for money. How do you see that working out with the Chinese yuan and the other currencies?
Well, you're putting me into the deep water really fast as a non-economist. I think that is one of the very interesting questions that is kind of surfacing right now in terms of this global crisis, because we know that the Chinese are holding debt. You know, one strategy is for them to try to denominate their trade in their own currency. And I don't know whether that is yet a strategy that would be possible for the Chinese to execute. It's clear that There are a lot of issues that are yet to really, make themselves felt in the context of this crisis. And I think for me to go any further would be, purely speculative. But it's going to be very interesting to see, whether or not the Chinese want to pursue that, how the Japanese would respond to that, because I think that they've also had the idea that the yen could be established as a regional currency. It certainly doesn't look like that project is going very well right at this moment. And then the future of the dollar, I hope that things recover, certainly. So. You took me way out of my depth.
Joy Watcher, in answering the question on trade expectations, you mentioned that you expected to see in the current turbulent economic environment growing friction between China and South Korea. And I was hoping you might elaborate on what kinds of friction you expect to see. And the magnitude of such friction. Do you expect it to be core to the China-South Korea relationship, or do you expect it to occur largely at the periphery?
At this stage, I would say that it's probably, economics has been, the economic growth has been used to paper over some other issues in the political sphere. And I think that it might be a little bit harder for those issues to be pushed aside. It might be a little bit more difficult. I mean, even in terms of public perceptions, some of the things that have kind of stuck in the craw on either side, it might be harder for them to be dealt with. And there are also some economic issues, economic components of the relationship that are becoming political problems. And I mentioned the fly-by-night operations in terms of the, labor-intensive Korean investments where the manager decides, okay, we're out of money, I'm going home, and that becomes a political problem that has to be managed.
That's not just Korean right now in China. I mean, that's a multinational phenomenon, including Chinese who are closing their shops. And
it's just that the Koreans started last year instead of
this year. They had a head start.
There's been some very complicated issues. This is really kind of on the periphery, but money scams that have come up. A lot of the quote-unquote phishing type activities in South Korea have been China-based, and so that's left a bad taste in the mouth of any Korean who's gotten ripped off. Also, I just learned that there's been a similar scam on the Korean side where a broker had been promising people who wanted to come and work in the Korean shipyards from China, that he would make that arrangement and then just taking their money. There's a town in Heilongjiang where there's something, a few hundred people who basically fell for that particular offer. So, I mean, that's. Not at this stage, and I don't think that it's. What I'm anticipating is more and more different types of frictions as political issues that have to be managed. But I don't really see those kinds of issues as driving any severe break in the relationship. There is an increasing concern in China about what does Lee Myung-bak mean by this strategic alliance for the 21st century. Ultimately, the types of issues that really hit nerves in the relationship are more related to the future of the Korean Peninsula. Will it be friendly to China or neutral or hostile? And then what type of approach is either government in Korea taking, and how does China perceive it? So they're concerned about the situation in South Korea. I think they're also concerned that in the context of a succession, how would they deal with a North Korea that if it were led by a leadership that was more hostile toward China. So.
This is Teddy Kim, and I was really impressed by your knowledge in two Koreas and China. And recently I witnessed that the Iranian president and the U.S. new president are sending messages for better relationships. And the main reason America is concerned about Iran is their nuclear ambition. And as far as North Korea is concerned, they already have some bombs. And what do you think about the American attitude, approach to North Korea?
I didn't cover that in the book, but okay. And really, we're waiting. I think the comments yesterday, I think by President Obama about Iran, certainly have some bearing on the. I think that the North Koreans were probably listening carefully and trying to figure out whether that could also apply to them. Certainly, from a proliferation perspective, Iran and North Korea are linked, and I think that the respective options and approaches also have kind of shadowed each other in various ways. It's interesting that it looks like the new administration is really going to start with Iran. I mean, I think one challenge that exists right now is that we don't have an envoy or a point person to drive policy toward North Korea. So I'm waiting to see how that is going to be resolved. I personally am advocating what I'm calling a one-way approach to dealing with North Korea at this stage. And what I mean by that is that traditionally U.S. policy toward North Korea has been presented as a matter of trying to make the North Koreans make a strategic decision by giving them a choice about different paths. I think that one problem with that particular way of looking at it is that it has put all the onus on North Korea to make the decision, and it has put us into a kind of situation where the U.S. side is just waiting for that decision to be made, but we haven't really done anything to create the conditions whereby North Korea would feel compelled to make a decision. And so I think that the approach should be that all of the members of the six-party talks are in this together. There's only one acceptable outcome that has been laid out through the six-party talks joint statement, and that there should be a combined effort to fulfill the objectives of the six-party talks. And that set of objectives, it's a consensus that has been created among those six parties. The North Koreans are also signed on to it. It offers the prospect of a normal diplomatic relationship for North Korea with Japan and with the United States. It offers economic development and peace, but it also requires denuclearization. And at this particular stage where we are, it seems to me that one of the critical things that has to happen is that the U.S. government needs to work with other members of the six-party talks to foreclose alternatives that North Korea might think that it has to pursuing the negotiation. And basically what I'm suggesting is that in addition to offering a prospect of continuing the negotiation and a set of positive outcomes for North Korea, that we're going to have to do more in order to work together with our allies and partners in Asia to build some pressure to encourage the North Koreans not to think that they can just wait and that maybe we'll lose our attention and move on to another issue. Because I don't think that I think that the region and the various players have already indicated that a non-nuclear Korean Peninsula is one of the objectives and one of the common principles that even the North Koreans signed up to in the six-party process. So I think we have to hold them to that. So I'm sorry that I'm actually doing a presentation later this week on that subject, so I'm sorry to give my presentation today. Right over here.
This is John Kim. Thank you for your presentation. My question is twofold. First, how economically is North Korea dependent on China? And a lot of South Koreans are worried that the North Korea may become a province of China. So is that a justified fear or is it an exaggeration? And the other question is a security issue. I mean, there is a security agreement between China and North Korea. And if something happens in the future, do you think China will still honor that security agreement by sending troops? Thank you.
Okay. Well, on the first question, in fact, I think the Chinese themselves have been debating about their commitment to that particular security agreement. And I think that it's pretty clear that if North Korea initiates any kind of hostilities, that the Chinese have already conveyed the message that pact would not apply. There's also been, I think that so far it appears that the Chinese government has opted just to leave ambiguity around the existing agreement rather than try to do anything to abrogate it. Partly, I think, because they're worried about a negative response from North Korea. The other part of your question was related to China's economic leverage. I have this in the book, but as of 2006, the Chinese share of North Korea's trade was about 39%, 40%. Inter-Korean trade is not included in the international trade figures, but if you take the inter-Korean trade and put it together with the international trade figures, and in fact the figure that I gave for China incorporates South Korea into that, South Korea is at about 31% as of 2006. I think that in both cases there has been a continued upswing. It'll be interesting to see over the course of the last year whether China's share increases as a result of the maybe a possible slowdown in the inter-Korean economic relationship.
My name is Cambria, and I'm retired. I found your talk rather interesting, and your paradigm seems to repose on this the conceit that there is stasis between China, North Korea, and South Korea. Since the economic downturn in the markets, this is no longer true. I think that China and South Korea are potential, as you suggested, competitors because they have the same export model of economics, and they're both tied very tightly to the global market, which is shrinking very fast for what they do. However, that's not my question. My question is, do you treat the change within South Korea by Imam Bak's rather aggressive economic and political policy towards the North, which has disrupted any equilibrium on the Korean Peninsula and has revived a Cold War to such an extent that the North Koreans are talking about launching even bigger and better rockets. And therefore, also on that note, since you incorporated inter-Korean trade since 2006, if you take into account Imam Bach's policy towards the North, where he cut off aid, wouldn't you think that that number would have gone down?
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that question because you're making the case for a second volume. Okay, or at least
everyone's demise.
I do think that there are some significant issues that have been raised over the course of the past year that that are going to come up, and I don't know the figures yet. My sense is that the inter-Korean figures probably will have declined some. But it may not really show. It may end up not being a precipitous decline, because I know that the South Korean NGOs have remained active, and also, in fact, we may find. We'll have to wait and see. But it's possible that there could be a continuation in terms of aid this year from South Korea to North. Another factor is that, you know, Kumgang has gotten wiped out by that case where the tourist lady was shot. But Kaesong is still operating. One question there is whether the global crisis is making it hard for those companies to operate. So I take your point, and I would even extend it just slightly. To suggest that, you know, we're really watching the fallout in terms of the global crisis, in terms of what's happening in southern China, right? But it's also possible that that could have some impact in terms of North Korea. I mean, we've already seen an impact last year in terms of the effect of a global food price hike on North Korean prices and the resumption of significant aid from contributions from the United States via the World Food Program that had previously dwindled. So, I mean, all of those factors are definitely, you know, in play, and I think they're worth further careful examination. Let's see, you've been waiting very patiently.
Thank you. Hi, Kim, Cornell University. My question is coming back to China. Economic situation seems to be driving Chinese economy to focusing on domestic consumption. And the trade-based economy is shrinking. Probably in the future, many third, you know, industrial countries are curbing their export to United States and Western Europe. And what China going to be like once domestic market is open? Now the Japanese ex-premier Nakasone is in Seoul, and they are trying to form an alliance with the Lee Myung-bak to sort of revamp the strategy to China and how to trade them and so on. And then secondhandly, with the North Korea, is there any chance to really linking with the South Korea, forming some kind of economic alliance with South Korea in this situation and relating to U.S. on a different kind of level? Do you see any possibility with the, under this kind of economic situation, such a political situation may develop?
Yeah, that's a very interesting set of questions. I think a lot of people are hoping that it would be possible for the Chinese consumer market to develop. So far, it doesn't seem like it's there yet in ways that are significant enough to help be a driver for recovery in this global context. And whether or not the domestic economy, what the conditions are that would be necessary in order for it to be sufficiently mature, I mean, maybe you can talk about that. The scenario in terms of the economic relationship, given the political relationship right now, I find it difficult to imagine that that particular scenario would develop, both because, as the gentleman earlier mentioned, South Korea's policy toward the North is requiring more reciprocity, and also the North Koreans are seeking to focus on the United States while trying to marginalize South Korea. Do you want to take a shot at this China question?
Well, I would just add 2 cents on the issue. I think that's a very good point in the longer term about China's domestic market, and it speaks back to some of the other questions, you know, because the United States is facing a different version of this dilemma of sort of what does China's slowdown mean? And of course, China's slowdown to a great extent is the slowdown in the American consumer is slowing down China's booming export. I mean, I do think in the longer term, it's not going to have any impact on 2009, but in or 2010 either. But in the longer term, I think, and I'm sure Chinese Korean businesses are light years ahead of me in paying attention to this and looking for these opportunities. The Chinese market. And, you know, the average Chinese consumer, I mean, that is the ultimate driver that's coming. It's still a ways off. But this current crisis could be one more push. I mean, we'll see what the Chinese government does with this stimulus, how much of it is real, how much of it is actual new spending, and how well it's spent, and how much of it reaches deeper into the interior or into parts of rural areas. But there is a potential huge Chinese consumer base. And obviously Korea, South Korea, ultimately North Korea, they have incredible advantages just in terms of proximity, in terms of accessing, and even culturally in terms of accessing that market. So I do think in the much longer term that's something that will play heavily in the economic dynamics of this.
I just want to add one very important fact. In China last year, more cars were sold in China than in the United States. That means the consumer spending is increasing in China also.
Back there.
Thank you very much. Akiko Tsunami from Japanese Consular Office. I have a question regarding some of the security aspect of the relationship. As you presented in your presentation, I think there is a tendency, I think, of Korea to avoid making choice between China and the United States, which is quite understandable. At the same time, maybe I thought that some of the trends, some of the issues that are actually in progress could put that kind of attitude under pressure. For example, one could be the ongoing relocation of U.S. U.S. forces in Korean Peninsula, being consolidated to Pyeongtaek and then to Daegu, and then to being more deployable, not just army, but maybe more deployable, deployable type of capabilities could be more in Korea. So maybe that could be put the Korean attitude under pressure. Maybe another thing could be some of the contingency planning issues as well. People talk about concept plan being all transferred to operation planning, and then maybe, as you suggested, the future of the policy towards future of the Korean Peninsula as a whole, maybe boiled down for allies like Korea and the United States to a certain extent, long-term policy towards China. Do you think that kind of issues like the relocation of U.S. forces in Korea or the contingency planning in case of the sudden change situation in North Korea could put the attitude of South Korea avoiding making choices between allies and then non-allies under pressure? Thank you very much.
Yeah, in fact, I think I might have touched on that. I mean, this strategic flexibility issue that came up in 2005, 2006, I think it was, related to whether or not U.S. forces could be used, U.S. forces based in Korea could be used for off-peninsula missions, is one that the South Koreans were very sensitive about because of their concern that it might make U.S. forces available for any kind of cross-straits conflict or crisis. And the Korean government, I think, did a little bit of hand-wringing about whether or not they would be implicated or be perceived as subject to pressure related to that kind of issue. Also, you mentioned the contingency planning, and right now I think that that's getting more attention. But I've done another study, I know you know about it, where we look at the issue of contingencies, and one question that remains unresolved is really, in the event of instability in North Korea, in a situation where there were loose nuclear weapons, who would be responsible for securing those weapons? And I think that that raises a number of very sensitive questions, because we know that the Chinese also have contingency plans, and they're also concerned about that particular issue. So I think it would be very important for at some stage for the U.S. and China to develop some kind of basic understanding about what would be expected in terms of missions in that particular context. Another issue that I think is related to this that is kind of interesting that I didn't get into at all is really the implications of the difference in system between China and South Korea and how that can be a source of tension in the relationship. And I think that one interesting example is the issue of human rights and refugees. This issue of how China has dealt with North Korean refugees has been a very interesting challenge, I think, for the Sino-South Korean relationship. It's kind of a long-standing issue that they've had to deal with. But one example of the sort of system issue that I think is kind of interesting, if you really think about, Korean experience, there's a lot in China culturally that is quite familiar, but it is a different system. And the best story that I have to illustrate that, that I talk about a little bit in the book, is related to a National Assembly delegation from South Korea that went to northeastern China in order to investigate the situation related to refugees. And in good South Korean National Assembly fashion, they came back to Beijing and tried to hold a press conference in their hotel to announce the findings. Well, the Chinese authorities pulled the plug on the press conference. And, of course, the South Korean National Assemblymen were outraged. How could the Chinese possibly, pull the plug on their press conference? But I think that they had failed to take into account that China is a different system from South Korea. And so I find it interesting that they kind of made the mistake of thinking that they would be able to get away with, having a press conference on an issue that was of directly sensitive to the Chinese government. So, all those issues are there, and I think are potential sources of tension or even conflict between China and South Korea.
Yeah, I'm Benjamin Ho from, Beijing, Chinese from Beijing. My question is regarding your six-party talk. China had done a lot of work in the six-party talk, and we also worried about the recent relationship between the North Korea and the South Korea, And we also want to push at the six-party talk going ahead, but if the two Koreas, the relation is bad, how can we do that? What do you think of how to deal with this bad relationship between the two Koreas?
No, I agree with you that the downturn in the inter-Korean relationship is sobering. I've done some analysis of some of the reasons why that has occurred. And it's going to be a really interesting diplomatic challenge for the South to try to implement a strategy that might help in recovering. Couple of positive things that I might offer are that the inter-Korean relationship is always bad at the beginning of a new administration. So in some ways, maybe the biggest challenge is to get through the period where the North Koreans are getting used to a new type of leader in South Korea. Secondly, it's true that this administration in South Korea is looking to change the nature of the interaction. And that's also a kind of challenge to the North Koreans. I think they liked the other policy better. But the problem is that the other policy is simply not sustainable in terms of South Korean public opinion. And my own view is that ultimately, in terms of the inter-Korean relationship, South Korean public opinion is likely to be the critical driver in terms of shaping what is going to happen. I'm not sure the North Korean government fully takes that in. But it may be that we just have to kind of get through this process. And then there are things that neighbors can do in order to try to help encourage things to get back on track. And here I think that, back in the mid-1990s was also a period when South and North Korea, inter-Korean relations were very bad. But at that time, the agreed framework had been signed, and there was an organization called KEDO, Korean Energy Peninsula Energy Development Organization, which served as an indirect vehicle by which there could be inter-Korean contact. And so likewise, I was heartened to note that, in fact, there was a meeting last December between the North and South Korean negotiators, even though they are not usually the primary players in inter-Korean relations. As representatives of their respective foreign ministries, they at least did meet. And then also I think it's notable that it was possible for a South Korean foreign ministry person to go up and talk very recently about issues related to fuel rods. So it's true that the environment is not very good right now and that it can have an impact in terms of what is possible to do, but I think that longer term, there may be factors that will play out that can hopefully help support a recovery in that relationship. Yes.
Josetta Capriati, International Public Relations. Where does Taiwan fit, if at all, in the scenario that you have described to us?
Okay, well, that's in the context of the China-Korea relationship, there is a way in which Taiwan, I think, figures into it. South Korea, at the time of normalization, made a major change because Taiwan at that time really counted on Korea as one of its major diplomatic partners. And in the book, I detail some of the problems that developed as South Korea saw the potential strategic advantages of establishing a normal relationship with Beijing. They really handled the unwinding of the relationship with Taiwan in a very poor way. And so that has really left, I think, a scar. It's only been the last few years during which we could say that that relationship has begun to recover to some degree. But still, I would say that South Korea is really one of the countries that is most deferential to Chinese policy related to Taiwan. At the same time, there have been a number of frictions that have developed related to Korea-Taiwan relations. Most notably, former South Korean President Kim Il-sung decided to go to the inauguration of Chen Shui-bian back in 1996, I think it was, and or 2000. And that resulted in essentially Chinese embassy condemning Kim Il-sung and also trying to block a number of the legislators. That played very poorly in South Korea because it was seen as China using direct pressure on a political issue that, from a South Korean perspective, it was just a little bit too overbearing. Maybe I should. The Taiwan element of the China-Korea relationship is really more a footnote to the story, and I don't want to get into switching to cross straits because that's
Although it is, I was fascinated to learn more about that because I mean it, you know the Chinese got a really good deal. You know the price of normalization from the Chinese side was to denormalize, to abnormalize with Taiwan. And South Korea, I mean, this is one of your points, that there were geostrategic hopes that didn't come true, that South Korea had higher expectations that somehow normalizing with Beijing was going to help vis-a-vis North Korea, even help towards reunification, which it didn't whatsoever. So it's a very interesting part of the book, actually, I found.
Last question, maybe, in that. No?
Maybe not.
Maybe there's nothing more to be said, but again, about the Taiwan question that the moderator alluded to discussion in your book, and I'm curious as to whether part of the Korean thought process with regard to deferring so extensively toward China and Taiwan was related to hoping for a logical extension of being given that type of freedom within the Korean Peninsula. Maybe that's obvious, but it would be interesting if you have anything else to add on that.
No. Well, that's, I think, exactly what John was referring to, is that essentially the Koreans kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge were expecting that maybe China would deliver North Korea somehow into their hands. And of course, the Chinese had a very different view of the way in which they wanted to handle the relationship with North Korea. And so in a way, as I referred to earlier, one of the interesting aspects of that particular story of normalization was how, I mean, the Chinese eventually did make that decision based on, I think, primarily economic motives. But for instance, if you compare how they handled it to the way that the Soviets handled it, you know, the Chinese obviously have positioned themselves in a much better way. Incidentally, I also used as one of the sources, Chen Shih-chun, the former foreign minister, was one of the was the individual who had to go and deliver the bad news. He has a diplomatic memoir out, which is very interesting to hear him talk about, how he showed up at the airport. Everybody kind of knew what was happening, but then nobody saw him off, you know, after he delivered that news. So it's very interesting.
Well, let's all give Scott a round of applause. Thank him.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you, John.
And buy his book on the way out, right?
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, or management. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.